We read it so you don't have to today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Mueller report is out, and the attorney general says no Americans knowingly helped Russia interfere in our elections.
That is something that all Americans can and should be grateful to have confirmed.
We examine the substance of the report this hour, looking beyond all the redactions.
Looks like about a third of that paragraph is blacked out.
And then Manafort recalled that Trump responded that Manafort should redact it. Manafort was getting pressure about redacted.
Also today, North Korea sends a series of provocative signals and a woman with albinism on the cover of Vogue.
It took quite a while for me to understand beauty in terms of me just being me.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Have you read the Mueller report yet? The redacted version released today by Attorney General William Barr is available to everyone now online. All 448 pages, redactions, footnotes, and all. It is a lot, and contrary to what President Trump has been saying over and over, it is not a complete exoneration. Trump has long tried to discredit Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe.
It was an illegal investigation.
And simple witch hunt.
This Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story.
But today we can finally see for ourselves most of what Mueller and his team concluded. We're going to go over the report in detail, starting with The World's Matthew Bell, who's in the studio with me. And Matthew, just remind us how the day started with that press conference from AG William Barr this morning.
The Attorney General's news conference was striking for a couple of reasons. First, he was appearing before the report was even released, so there were already criticism, complaints about this being an effort to spin the thing before people could even have a look at it. But Barr also contradicted something that we've heard from Donald Trump throughout this whole story. The Attorney General did not say that this was a witch hunt, that this was a politicized investigation. He described it as a serious look into a serious matter. And that was about Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Then Barr went further to characterize Mueller's findings on collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign.
The Russian government sought to interfere in our election process. But thanks to the special counsel's thorough investigation, we now know that the Russian operatives who perpetrated these schemes did not have the cooperation of President Trump or the Trump campaign, or the knowing assistance of any other American, for that matter. That is something that all Americans can and should be grateful to have confirmed.
So Attorney General Barr said several times that there was no collusion. But then about an hour after his news conference wrapped, everybody with an internet connection finally got the chance to read the Mueller report for themselves. What'd they see?
The moment arrived. As we expected, this is sizable. It's almost 450 pages. There are parts of it that have been redacted. What's in there is instructive to me because I think, you know, it starts to get at the reasoning from Robert Mueller himself of what they've been doing for almost 2 years, why they made the conclusions that they did. And on the big question of collusion, the report explains that this is not a legal term and that the real question for the special counsel's office was about conspiracy. On the president's conduct, the report says, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would state so. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment.
Matthew, hang on a second. I'm going to bring in Garrett Graff. He's the author of Mueller's War, available on Scribd. Garrett, thanks for being here. Let me pick up with that last thought from Matthew. We are unable to reach that judgment on obstruction. So is that it? It all ends there?
Not at all. And one of the things that actually seems most surprising as we get our chance to sink our own teeth into this 448-page report is that it is not nearly as cut and dry as Attorney General Barr seemed to represent it to be. That it seems quite clear actually from reading Mueller's own words and his own framing that part of the reason that he decided not to bring charges against the president for obstruction is that he was operating under the Justice Department guidance that says that the president cannot be indicted while in office. And that, in fact, Mueller explicitly says that he believes that it is up to Congress to pick up the questions of whether these acts of possible obstruction rose to corrupt acts and corrupt use of power by the president, because Congress is ultimately the body that is constitutionally delineated to deal with questions of presidential malfeasance in an impeachment proceeding. And so if you read between the lines, and actually almost explicitly in a couple of places, Mueller really seems to be framing his view of obstruction as a referral to Congress to pick up and deal with whether this is something that they feel rises to the level of impeachment.
Looking at the report as a whole, Garrett, what did you find most important? What jumped out at you?
I think it's actually that. It's that this is not quite the no collusion, no obstruction that Barr told us it was, you know, almost a month ago now, and that the president has claimed, you know, total exoneration, exclamation point, out of this report. And that in many ways it is more troubling than we had perhaps imagined, given that we knew already that it didn't find a provable conspiracy. And I think sort of one of the things that, again, becomes clear in multiple places in here is that one of the reasons that Mueller says that he couldn't find conspiracy, he couldn't prove conspiracy, was in part because he didn't he wasn't able to get all of the facts that he wanted, and that he says explicitly in one place that if he was able to gather additional facts that might shed additional light or cast in a new light some of the activities that he's investigating.
Were you surprised by the number of redactions, Garrett?
I'm actually not. It seems in many ways an appropriate level of redaction, particularly given, and this is another one of the surprises that we see coming out of this report, the number of ongoing investigations. Mueller makes clear in this report that there are, in fact, at least 14 other investigations that he has referred out to other prosecutors that are still ongoing, 12 of which are redacted and secret in this document, and only two of which we actually know publicly, one involving Michael Cohen, the president's former lawyer and fixer, and the other, which just moved forward in the last couple of weeks, is the prosecution of Greg Craig, former White House counsel under President Obama, indicted for some of his work with Paul Manafort on behalf of the government of Ukraine.
Garrett, we may be hearing more from Bob Mueller, though, because we now know that the Democrats want to bring him in and have him testify. Do you think we could learn more from him, or is he just going to pull out a copy of his report and start reading from it?
I can't imagine that he would go much beyond in congressional testimony what is already in this report. But I think particularly given the vast gulf, legally speaking at least, between what Barr has summarized and what Mueller has written in the report himself, Democrats really have to bring Bob Mueller to Capitol Hill to testify himself. And Barr, in his press conference today, made clear that he would have no objection to that.
Garrett, I imagine you're going to be going through those 448 pages with a fine-tooth comb for the next couple of days. But sort of looking beyond that, how do you think this story is going to end?
So I have to say, I think that's a more open question today in the afternoon than it was this morning before we saw this report. It seemed very clear that up until this morning, impeachment, for instance, was off the table, that Nancy Pelosi had made clear that that was not going to be a path that House Democrats were interested in going down. Given the ultimately damning evidence that has been gathered in parts of this report, it seems hard to imagine that Democrats will not be holding at least some hearings to follow up on this, even if they do stop short of impeachment. This is in some ways a much more troubling report, I think, than we had been imagining we were going to be seeing today.
Garrett Graff, the author of Mueller's War, available on Scribd. Garrett, thanks for being in this conversation today. Really appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure.
Obviously, there's one country other than the USA at the heart of the Mueller probe, Russia. For The View from Moscow today, we turn to Mikhail Fishman. He's an anchor at Russia's independent TV, RAIN. It's getting late there in Moscow, Mikhail, but is the release of the redacted Mueller report making headlines there?
State news agencies already started covering the release of the report, and the headlines are that Attorney General William Barr confirmed that there was no collusion between Russia and Trump. And I assume this is the perspective from which the report will be covered in all official media during the rest of the week.
Yeah, no collusion, but we've got a report that implicates Russians of various stripes in a dirty tricks campaign. What are people saying about that?
Well, you have to understand that initial Kremlin's reaction to Robert Mueller's findings and official state television reaction a few weeks ago was very joyful and triumphant. And Vladimir Putin had already commented after the release of the findings. He said something like, much cry and little wool. And from here, the conclusions of the report are that Russia did not meddle in the U.S. election. And there was no collusion between Trump and Russia. They basically mix it in one finding. So this is the perspective from which it is officially covered. Deliberately misinterpreting Mueller's report's findings, mixing meddling and collusion into sort of one process.
Kind of sounds like the Kremlin's rhetorical way of just shrugging it off.
Yes, that's what they usually, well, what would you expect?
So I'm going to have you generalize here, but after 2 years of investigation, do most Russians know their government attempted to influence the 2016 U.S. election and help President Trump win?
It's a tricky question, and the answer would be tricky because, yes, they do know, and at the same time, they don't. Russia has never confirmed it did meddle into election, yet on some level, between the lines, it sort of did, and it proves Russia's ability to influence matters across the world.
And then there's that story that falls right there in Moscow, the Trump Tower deal. It ultimately did not get that building built, but the details, as you know, are pretty tantalizing. Maybe Putin was promised a penthouse suite. I mean, do most Russians know about that whole story?
No, no. Most of Russians just do not know anything about it.
And why not? Did the news never make it there?
Well, when we talk about news, we talk about official television and propaganda. And this is not news. This is something very different. Of course, they will not be covering, and they never did. They never covered the Steele dossier. They never covered the details of the whole meddling process. They just come out with their own perspective. They do it constantly. They sort of create their own agenda, which differs very much from what happens in the real world.
So now that the Mueller report, at least in its redacted form, is out there, do you see any signs that the White House and the Kremlin are still hoping for some kind of reset in relations, or is that just evaporated at this point?
Of course, Mueller's findings prove for Putin and for the Kremlin that the Kremlin has succeeded in his ultimate goal to help Trump get elected and to damage Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate. Of course, they would try to build on this accomplishment, and Putin would be interested in some kind of a summit and move to something else. But all these aspirations, they get stuck into current agenda, which is now about Venezuela, for example, or Ukraine or anything else. So I wouldn't expect much of a turn. But still, I think the Kremlin would think of capitalizing on the Mueller's report, of course.
Mikhail Fishman, an anchor at Russia's independent TV Rain. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
The World's Matthew Bell is still with me here in the studio. So you've been poring over the Mueller report today, covering all the reaction for us. Now that it is out, where does this whole thing go next?
Remember that the Mueller investigation was only one investigation among numerous investigations into the Trump campaign, the Trump business organization. There are cases at the D.C. Circuit in New York, for example, that are still playing out. People that still – some of these characters that appear in the Mueller report haven't been finally sentenced yet. Also, I think Congress is the place to look. Jerry Nadler today at the House Judiciary Committee said that as far as he's concerned, this Mueller report is not complete. That's because of the redactions. Mm. He wants to bring Mueller himself in to testify in Congress. And he says that the Trump administration has not fully cooperated.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks very much for your reporting on this very important story.
Thanks, Marco.
We'll have more analysis of the Mueller report later in the show, including what the document says about the matter of possible obstruction of justice. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. The impressive voice of Salif Keita, the singer from Mali in West Africa, announced his retirement recently. His music will endure, though, as will his advocacy on behalf of people with albinism, Salif is one of them, and he's widely recognized for opening up the discussion in Africa and around the world. Salif Keita's got allies elsewhere in Africa, too, who've joined this fight in their own way, people like Thando Hopa. She's a lawyer and activist from South Africa and now a model, the first person with albinism ever to appear on a Vogue cover, specifically this month's Vogue Portugal edition dedicated to the diversity of African beauty. Thando Hopa joins us now. Hi, Thando.
Hi, Marco.
My first question actually is not from me, but from a social worker and black woman with albinism from Chicago. Her name is Brandy Marie, and she was really stoked to see you on the cover of Vogue Portugal, and she has a question for you. I'll let her start.
I got really emotional because I just haven't seen myself. Like, growing up, I didn't see myself. I looked through these magazines wanting to see myself represented, and I never did. And I am wondering about how it felt to be in the beauty space and to be called beautiful after growing up and hearing that you were not beautiful or teased, and then sort of how you process that.
Thando Hopa, how do you answer that?
I think, you know, when I grew up, I grew up having parents who were absolutely wonderful, who told me that I was beautiful all the time. But then, you know, when I went into society and I looked at the media space, I wasn't represented with respect to what was portrayed as beautiful. So I started developing inadequacy as I really had a relationship with society. It took quite a while for me to understand beauty in terms of me just being me, in terms of me accepting that my eyebrows are pale, my eyelashes are pale, that my hair is curly and blonde as opposed to curly and black, you know. Mm. I had to go into the modeling industry understanding that my purpose was to focus on representation and saying that the way I look is enough, whether I am on a Vogue cover or not. To be quite honest, when I saw that, when I saw myself on a Vogue cover, I felt more relief than happiness, to be honest.
Relief how?
In that I had gone through so many battles. And a lot of the times when you're going through all of these nuanced battles with respect to representation, when you actually kind of get there, more than anything, you just feel relief that, you know what, I've managed to do this representation to the best of my ability, my way.
I know you've probably told this story many times by now, but maybe one more time if you could share it with us. How did you go from lawyer and activist to being a model?
I was a prosecutor, and I used to prosecute in sexual offense cases. And what happened is I decided to take a sabbatical, but I had already started my modeling career at the time. I went into it as a platform of representation.
So modeling was activism for you, is activism. How did the industry, the modeling industry, respond to a woman with albinism who is also an activist for albinism?
I started experiencing a great deal of boxing and stereotyping. It was a constant narrative of, you know, prejudice in Africa. And it wasn't that the narrative was not significant or important, it's that it became an all-consuming narrative, and it started almost chipping away at my complete humanity, in that I had experiences that people just did not consider important anymore. I was only the story.
Did you ever think about maybe modeling isn't the way to do this kind of activism?
You know, to be quite honest with you, I think it was one of the best ways, because media was a negotiating medium. It helped negotiate a new narrative with respect to anything, really, and albinism was one of them. So I started learning how to kind of harness a more complete identity with respect to how people see albinism using media through the modeling space.
And then how did this Vogue cover come about?
I received an email from Portugal. They said that it's a cover opportunity. And I thought to myself, cover? I didn't believe it, to be honest with you. And then I went to my mother and I said to him, like, I received an email and it said that it wants to do this particular thing. And they wanted to talk about my work as a diversity advocate. And she said, oh my gosh, do you know there's this human trafficking stuff that's going on? What if these people want to take you to Cape Town and, you know, they're trying to traffic you?
Wow.
And I said to her, and you know, like literally that's how far-fetched the thought was, and we kind of had to do a lot of due diligence to believe it.
Mm. Where was it shot?
It was shot in Cape Town. Mm. I actually brought some of my family jewelry that was very Southern African, because it was, representation is very multifaceted. Yes, there is the woman with albinism, but there's the Southern African Xhosa Sotho woman. And I kind of wanted to do my best to bring sort of everybody with me the best way I could.
Speaking of identity, Tando, I've really been wanting to ask you this question since I learned about your story. Mm-hmm. South Africa, known for apartheid, a government policy that separated whites from blacks for years in society. What did that do mm-hmm. to your own understanding of who you are?
Oh, that's a very intense question. The interesting thing I've learned is race is an institution that really was bred from a figment of somebody's imagination, but had very real consequences that lived beyond color. Because I am a black woman that still experiences the consequences of what race is, and I don't have the color. But I learned something being in this body. The issue isn't racism, isn't patriarchy, isn't issues with respect to albinism. The issue is that we have a behavioral defect with how we deal with difference.
When do you think, Tando, it won't be a big deal anymore for a person with albinism to be on a cover of Vogue or any fashion magazine, when it's just a model on the cover and she just happens to have albinism?
It's a very difficult question to answer, because I think right now we're getting to a point where people are celebrating firsts quite a lot. You know, you're the first woman to do this. You're the first black person to do that. You're the first person with albinism to do that. You're the first otherly abled person to do this. Firsts are usually kind of a point of progress. The more you kind of get frequency of representation, the more you'll be able to normalize something that is considered extraordinary. Probably frequency would help a lot, because the frequency would kind of not make it a deviance. It would make it a normalization. We kind of need to start setting values that allow for that kind of progress and diversity and inclusion.
Well, Tando Hopa, the photographs with this first in Vogue are gorgeous, and in no small part because of your presence. So keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
More analysis of the Mueller report out today. That's all still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. 174 people are named in the Mueller report, and one of them joins us ahead this hour. Mary McCord led the Russia investigation before Robert Mueller was appointed. The former Justice Department official gives us her take on the questions of obstruction of justice. That and much more still ahead on The World. All eyes on Washington today with the long-anticipated release of a redacted version of the Mueller report. But there is other news happening around the globe, including this announcement from North Korea. The regime in Pyongyang said it has successfully tested a new tactical guided weapon. Pyongyang also said it no longer wants to negotiate with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And it was also announced that leader Kim Jong-un will hold a summit with Vladimir Putin in Russia later this month. Sounds like the hat trick of provocations to me. Vipin Narang is a nuclear policy expert at MIT. Let's start with this new weapon test. What was it, most likely?
So I don't think we know exactly what it was. By all accounts, it seems like a tactical missile system, probably something like an anti-tank guided missile system. It's probably not nuclear capable. I think this is probably in line with the last couple of days. Kim Jong-un has been visiting his conventional military forces, probably trying to boost their morale, check their readiness. And until we get a picture or more details, I think it's probably best to assume that it certainly wasn't a ballistic missile. The United States did not detect a missile launch. So I think it's more of a conventional tactical system for the conventional forces. And I think it's part of a broader pattern about Kim Jong-un, I think, increasing the readiness, trying to signal, remember what can happen if diplomacy falls apart. But in a lot of ways, it's calibrated because it's not a real significant provocation.
What was the reaction from the Pentagon about this weapon test? And does that kind of give us any further details about what it might be?
I haven't seen any major reaction. I think a lot of people are in wait-and-see mode at the moment. The more concerning developments have probably been, you know, Kim Jong-un never said he would stop producing nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles, but we're seeing renewed activity at some of the facilities associated with their nuclear and ballistic missile program. And, you know, I think since Hanoi, Kim Jong-un has signaled, look, I can load my gun again. I haven't fired it yet, but just remember what can happen if this whole process falls apart.
Right, the Hanoi meeting of the last summer.
Correct.
Then North Korea says they don't want to negotiate with Mike Pompeo anymore.
Oh, yeah, Kim special.
What's that about?
This is, yeah. So, you know, I think in front of Congress the other day, Secretary Pompeo referred to Kim Jong-un as a tyrant, and they reacted very badly. It was very interesting to me that they referred specifically to that in this press release. And they are basically saying, look, we can't negotiate with somebody who abuses Kim Jong-un. And I think they blame Pompeo and John Bolton for introducing the poison pill, what I call the Hanoi holdup, right? So Kim Jong-un shows up in Hanoi expecting President Trump to live up to what he's been saying publicly about, oh, I'm satisfied as long as Kim Jong-un isn't testing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. And I think North Korea was expecting kind of an interim step-by-step deal. And we're probably legitimately surprised and shocked when President Trump handed them a piece of paper basically demanding Kim Jong-un to hand over the keys to his nuclear kingdom. And they said, thanks, but no thanks. We're going to get on the train back to Pyongyang. And so I think there's a strong belief in Pyongyang and the negotiating team on the North Korean side that Pompeo and Bolton were responsible for the downturn in this process. And they're very happy and very cleverly reserving a lot of praise for President Trump still.
And then the third point, Vipin, this announcement that Kim Jong-un is going to have a summit meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the end of this month. How significant is that?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most significant development in the last day or so, because, you know, as part of taking the air out of the maximum pressure campaign, North Korea has really relied on black market trade with China and Russia. And there's a longstanding relationship between the Soviet Union, Russia, and North Korea. So this summit is actually reinvigorating an old alliance that North Korea had. Kim Jong-un has repaired his relationship, as far as we can tell, with China. When he first came into office, there's a lot of tension with China. And I think if I'm Kim Jong-un, I think, you know, I don't want to put all my eggs in the China basket. And so this opening and leader-level summit with Putin of Russia, I think is really important for the North Koreans to have multiple options to break effectively the UN and U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
Vipin Narang, a nuclear policy expert at MIT, thanks very much for explaining this.
Thank you so much for having me.
After Hurricane Maria slammed into Puerto Rico in September 2017, the healthcare system there was hit hard. Many hospitals had to limit services to patients. Some closed their doors entirely. Now healthcare providers on the island are rethinking what preparedness means and how to survive another storm. One doctor is focusing on preparing pregnant women who could go into labor during a storm. Irina Zhorov has our story from San Juan.
Yahaira Molina Perez was 8 months pregnant when Hurricane Maria hit. In her town of Sidra, downed trees and power lines made roads almost impassable. Yahaira wasn't too worried, though. She wasn't due for weeks. But just 5 days after the storm, she started having contractions. The roads were such a mess that the trip to the hospital in San Juan took twice as long as usual.
Pero justo cuando llego, que veo que todo ese primer piso está lleno de arena porque...
As soon as we arrive, I see the whole first floor full of sand because the hospital in San Juan is near the beach. I see broken glass. I climb the stairs because the elevator is damaged, and the floor where they're attending to pregnant women was dark. And the nurses had their pants and sleeves rolled up because there was no air conditioning.
The hospital was only handling emergencies, and Yahaira wasn't ready to give birth. So she and her husband, Raul Malave Coto, headed back to Sidra. On the way, they stopped at Yahaira's mom's house, and Yahaira's water broke.
Yo lo que pensaba era, wow, yo no me preparé para esto.
I was thinking, wow, I did not prepare for this. I never even considered giving birth at home.
There were no phones, no communication, but through the grapevine, they heard that an obstetrician lived in the neighborhood, and they knocked on his door. He brought his wife, a nurse.
Yo no tenía mi expediente conmigo, o sea, en un momento dado si
I didn't have my medical file with me. In other words, if at any point the doctor asked me something about my condition, I didn't know what to tell him.
Yahaira says the emergency generator roared, another reminder of the chaos outside. She was scared.
Yo gritaba de miedo. Yo no gritaba de dolor, yo gritaba de miedo.
I was yelling out of fear. I wasn't yelling because of pain. I yelled from fear.
But this is a happy story. After a brief labor, Raul Leandro was born healthy. The toddler squirms in his father's arms and points into the jungle just beyond the family's hilltop house. Where's the bobcat? His father asks. The bobcat in question is the small front loader Raul, who owns a landscaping business, used to clear roads after the storm. Yahaira says it's her son's favorite thing in the world. In San Juan, Carmen Zoria heard of several unplanned home births like Yahaira's after the storm, and it worried her. She's an obstetrician at the island's main public hospital.
For these women, this was a stressful situation, so that was my eye-opening experience.
In 2013, in a first for Puerto Rico, Carmen introduced a non-traditional approach to care for women with high-risk pregnancies. The model relies on group prenatal appointments rather than one-on-one checkups. It's called Centering Pregnancy. Funding issues and the hurricane put the program on hiatus, but it's back now. And Carmen thinks it can be adapted for hurricane preparedness. At a recent appointment, 9 pregnant women, each with a support person, file into a small room in the hospital.
They come and they wait themselves and tell the nurse, okay, my weight is this. They take their own blood pressure with a monitor. So they are taking care of their own health right then. They are empowered. They are involved in their care.
Today, the group is discussing common problems during pregnancy. The facilitator, Dianca Sierra Vega, hands out cards, each with a different issue written on it. She tells them to act them out, charade style. One of the women lets out an angry growl. Mood swings. I get them, one of the women says. I can't even stand myself. The others commiserate. They act out headaches, swollen feet, aching backs, constipation. Dianca and Carmen explain the science of what's happening to their bodies. It's all informal, and the women are totally engaged.
That's part of what they gain, and being part of a group, there's social support.
Initially, Carmen introduced group appointments because the island has a high rate of premature and underweight babies. And studies show when pregnant women participate in group appointments, babies are more likely to be born closer to their due dates. No one knows precisely how the groups work, but Carmen thinks they reduce stress. When the storm season officially begins in June, she'll use the model to teach hurricane preparedness in new sessions.
And we're going to talk about how do you prepare for unplanned home delivery? How do you cut the cord? What things could you have?
The idea is to give the women practical know-how, as well as the confidence to stay calm if a storm barrels towards the island again.
The concept of group prenatal care is basically you're in control of your health. And having the information on what to do with an emergency labor and delivery, I think gives them peace of mind.
Yaisha Roja is one of the women in today's group. This is her second pregnancy, and she's due in October, hurricane season.
Uno siempre tiene que estar precavido. Pasa un huracán.
One should always take precautions. Perhaps there's a hurricane, and there aren't many hospitals open. There's traffic. That's why this is important.
Carmen Zoria still thinks women should plan on hospital births. They're safer, she says. But just in case there's another disaster, she wants women to be prepared.
I say that we have like community PTSD. Now that we live not just a hurricane, but the aftermath, the complete disruption of the power grid, everybody's concerned. And now we know that we need to be ready for this.
For the World, Irina Zhurov, San Juan.
A month ago, a devastating storm ravaged 3 countries on the southeast coast of Africa. Cyclone Idai killed more than 1,000 people in Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. Today, people in Zimbabwe gathered under more rain to celebrate Independence Day, 39 years since the end of British rule there. And for the first 37 years of independence, Zimbabweans had just one ruler, President Robert Mugabe. Now Emmerson Mnangagwa is in charge. The BBC's Shangai Nyoka was in the capital Harare for today's ceremonies.
It was quite a damp anniversary this year. Lots of rain, but tens of thousands of people came out for the military parades, for the displays and the music concerts. It's quite a festive occasion. But generally, people are asking what has changed. And I think that was one of the main issues at this year's independence.
So Independence Day today, but it's been a month or so since the destruction of Cyclone Idai. What kind of damper did that put on festivities today?
Well, that was one of the issues that was raised by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who led the celebrations, is that Zimbabwe might be celebrating. But he also alluded to the fact that Zimbabweans had really shown the spirit of unity by coming together, donating clothes and food. A lot of volunteer doctors and aid workers went out there to assist, and he commended that.
What are things like after the cyclone?
Many people are still trying to rebuild, and the operation that started all those weeks ago is still not over. And not all of the people have been recovered. The government and even private sector companies have been out there to try to remove some of the stones. I mean, we talk about a cyclone, but I think the reasons for the devastation is the fact that these granite boulders came crashing down from the mountains into these people's homes and burying some of these communities. And so there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. The roads have been opened up to access some of these areas, but still people are looking for their loved ones that they lost.
What about the meaning of these celebrations, this Independence Day celebration, since Emmerson Mnangagwa was elected leader last year? How are people marking this day differently than other Independence Days in the past?
You'll remember last year, Emmerson Mnangagwa had been in power for about 6 months, had swept into power through this military coup, and there was still a lot of optimism. He was making the right moves, saying the right things in terms of ending corruption, declaring financial interests among his government officials, warning that there'd be arrests for corruption. But a year later, the mood has changed quite dramatically. None of those top officials that he arrested have been successfully prosecuted. The economy has worsened, in fact, worse so than it was under President Robert Mugabe. The price of bread doubled this week. The price of fuel doubled in January. And so people are still trying to understand why this is happening when there were so many promises for change that Emmerson Mnangagwa made when he came into power 18 months ago.
Speaking of change, Shanghai, outside of Zimbabwe, as you know, there are rumblings of an African spring in Sudan and Algeria. Next month in South Africa, there are elections. What do all these developments mean for Zimbabweans?
Well, Zimbabweans are watching all of the events happening around Africa with a great deal of interest. There have been a lot of lessons learned from the way Emmerson Mnangagwa took power. And many people are hoping that in Sudan, the same lessons will be learned. In Algeria, the same lessons will be learned. That just because you change a person at the top, it doesn't mean that the whole system has been dismantled. The military that propped Robert Mugabe is still propping Emmerson Mnangagwa. They've now been given these positions within government, but that very little in terms of the power has changed. And I think that's the biggest advice that Zimbabweans would give to the Sudanese and to Algerians, is that make sure that the whole system is dismantled once and for all.
My BBC colleague, Shingai Nyoka, speaking with us from Harare, the Zimbabwean capital. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Before the Mueller report was released today, a big question many people had was, what did the special counsel's team conclude about possible obstruction of justice by the president? There are several mentions in the document of possible obstructive acts, so we're going to drill down on that and other issues with Mary McCord. She's the former Justice Department official who led the Russia investigation before Robert Mueller was appointed. Mary, good to have you with us today. Frequently in the Mueller report, there's discussion of President Trump's obstructive acts, like firing FBI Director James Comey and his intentions. So at what point do intentions and so-called obstructive acts become obstruction of justice?
So I think one of the points of confusion for people is the difference between sort of what lay people would think and understand as obstruction of justice and what the crime of obstruction of justice is. And so the crime of obstruction of justice requires an obstructive act, like you indicated, and a nexus between that obstructive act and the proceeding that you want to obstruct, meaning sort of a direct connection, that it's a natural and probable consequence of the obstructive act that you would actually achieve obstructing the proceeding. And then finally, corrupt intent. And by corrupt intent, the Supreme Court has said a wrongful, even evil intent is what is meant by corrupt intent. And so what this report does is it never reaches a conclusion. Robert Mueller purposefully didn't reach a conclusion about whether any of the obstructive acts would actually meet the criteria for charging the crime of obstruction. William Barr made that conclusion when he sent his four-page letter to Congress a couple of weeks ago that he didn't think it could meet the elements of obstruction beyond a reasonable doubt. But whether you're talking about it in the layperson sense or the actual chargeable criminal offense sense, intent, of course, is important, the intent to obstruct.
What are your major takeaways from the report, Mary?
So on that part specifically, that's part two of the report, the obstruction of justice. You know, I have not been able to read the full report. I've read the executive summary of both part one and part two, and they're very informative alone. I think you would have a hard time coming away from reading these executive summaries and not believing that the president, at least in, again, layperson's terms, intended to do his best to obstruct this investigation. And there's many, many different examples of conduct that feeds into that conclusion. So I think it's important, I think, and, you know, it's a credit to Barr that he went ahead and, you know, made this report public. I may disagree with him on some things, but it's to his credit that he got this out and available to the public quickly so that people can read it. And I encourage people to read it so that they can make their assessment about the conduct that the president engaged in and whether that, you know, and how that impacts them as they go into this next election. I mean, the past is the past. Mm. We have the report now, but this is a person who's currently running for election. And I think that's also one reason why Robert Mueller felt that it was important to be so fulsome in the evidentiary presentation.
Having been there at the beginning of the investigation, Mary, is there anything you were expecting in the report that's missing?
So just to be clear, when I was there at the Department of Justice, the investigation at that point was, you know, really all about the Russian election interference. So I left on May the 12th, just a couple of days after Director Comey was fired and just a couple of days before Robert Mueller was appointed. So sort of this obstruction piece of it really all came after I left. But with respect to the Russian election interference, I think we've known from the indictments and from other public reporting and other information that has been put out by the government over the last couple of years that we had, you know, major Russian influence campaigns. And I think what you get with the conclusion here, again, is that nothing rose to the level of a criminal conspiracy between members of the Trump campaign and the Russian government.
We're going to have to leave it there. Mary McCord was there at the start of the Justice Department's Russia investigation. She left her position as acting assistant attorney general in 2017. She now teaches at Georgetown University. A reminder now of where we've been with this story today. It began this morning with a press conference by Attorney General William Barr.
The Deputy Attorney General and I concluded that the evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense.
Yep, that question again. Obstruction of justice was the big one on everyone's minds a few weeks ago. When special counsel Robert Mueller announced he'd finished his investigation and sent a final report to Barr's office. Mueller did not indict President Trump on obstruction of justice or any other charge, but the special counsel also clearly states in his report that he doesn't exonerate the president either. Journalist and Mueller biographer Garrett Graff has been following this saga closely, possibly closer than almost anyone. Here's his take today.
This is, in some ways, a much more troubling report, I think, than we had been imagining we were going to be seeing today.
Graff says where the criminal justice system may reach one conclusion, the political system could have another approach.
Mueller really seems to be framing his view of obstruction as a referral to Congress to pick up and deal with whether this is something that they feel rises to the level of impeachment.
Not to be lost in all of this are the actions of the Russian government. Attorney General Barr and Special Counselor Mueller agree the Russian government was active and persistent in disrupting the 2016 U.S. election. Barr said resolutely this morning the president had nothing to do with their efforts.
The Russian government sought to interfere in our election process. But thanks to the special counsel's thorough investigation, we now know that the Russian operatives who perpetrated these schemes did not have the cooperation of President Trump or the Trump campaign.
Mueller's report is more nuanced on that question. Mueller writes at length about the shades of difference between active conspiracy and unwitting help. In Russia, though, that nuance makes little difference, as independent Russian journalist Mikhail Fishman told me earlier.
Of course, Mueller's findings prove for Putin and for the Kremlin that the Kremlin has succeeded in his ultimate goal to help Trump get elected and to damage Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate. Of course, they would try to build on this accomplishment.
There is a lot to carefully read and examine in this 448-page report. If you'd have walked into our newsroom around 11:30 this morning, you would have seen our entire team reading silently and heard only the sound of keyboard typing as they took notes. Here's what we found.
I just finished, actually.
Some of these sections are really tantalizing.
I'm finding that it's not colorful like I expected it to be.
I think the report gets good on page 41. I think that's the money page.
They didn't think this would rise to the level of a criminal violation.
The goal was to get access to higher level officials.
Looks like about a third of that paragraph is blacked out.
And then Manafort recalled that Trump responded that Manafort should redact it. Manafort was getting pressure about redacted.
They recruited random people to do crazy stuff like walk around in Santa Claus outfits and Trump masks.
A lot of, I don't remember meeting so-and-so at this meeting,
specifying
but
how Trump was not happy at all.
And so it's really kind of, it feels like a trip back through time.
Gives you just a little idea of what our day was like today. So much more to say on the Mueller report, and we'll be following the story closely in the days ahead. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.